Anterior pelvic tilt, posterior pelvic tilt. These things are not what people think that they are. We will talk about the difference between what anterior pelvic tilt actually is in the literature versus what an anterior orientation is. And more importantly, we'll talk about what you can do about them and why posteriorly pelvic tilting or posteriorly orienting your pelvis is not the answer to fix an anterior pelvic orientation. All of that and more on today's episode of...
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Oh, okay. My goodness. So, oh, my goodness. Yes.
Anterior pelvic tilt. Something Bill doesn't like to talk about because it's very misunderstood. It's thrown around as this sort of blanket diagnosis for people's issues. They want to try to correct it through corrective exercises to try to fix their anterior pelvic tilt by jamming themselves into the opposing position and hoping for the best.
Yeah, it doesn't really work that way at all,
so
actually.
This is inspired by the YouTube AI overlords. And then also Bill wrote an article on the UHP network, UHP.network, for anyone that doesn't know about Bill's learning community, talking about how posterior orientation is not the answer for anterior orientation.
Is not.
And how that can actually work against you or exacerbate your issue. What I want to do first is explain what anterior pelvic tilt actually is in the literature. What the difference between anterior pelvic tilt and anterior orientation and posterior orientation are. And then we'll talk about some solutions for management afterwards.
Okay. So anterior pelvic tilt is actually a specific measured angle. Typically, you're going to see this represented in a two-dimensional representation. So they're going to take a picture of the pelvis from the side. You're going to have a representation of where the acetabulum is. You'll see the innominate, and then you'll have a visualization of the sacrum. Look at an x-ray from the side, you could sort of see through the pelvis and you could see this representation. Now, the description of the angle is difficult because it is described in the literature. And if you don't follow anatomy in depth, you wouldn't quite understand it. So that if you had a vertical line that went through the pelvis and straight through the dead center of the acetabulum, and so that line would actually find the dead center of the acetabulum itself. It goes through the vertical of the pelvis. There's another line that would go from that point, dead center of the acetabulum, and it would go to the dead center of the sacral base. And that angle forms what is referred to in the literature as pelvic tilt. So it's a very specific angle. What I think people typically refer to as a pelvic tilt is a change in the orientation of the pelvis as a whole, including the position of the lumbar spine. And so people will say, well, the curve of the lumbar spine increases, and then that changes the orientation of the pelvis, and therefore that is a pelvic tilt. And that is not necessarily true because of the influence of how the angle is measured. So you would say, oh, you have an increased pelvic tilt, but that might narrow the angle that is actually measured as the pelvic tilt. So it doesn't increase the angle. So we don't want to use that term because it has a very specific meaning. When we have the change in a position, so a position is represented by an orientation. And so when we say anterior orientation of the pelvis, what we're saying is there is no relative motion available between the sacrum and the innominates. And so the pelvis is moving as a whole, and it's changing its orientation to where the angle of the inlet is actually increasing. This would require that the lumbar spine moves into an IARD position, which people would see as the increase in curvature of the lumbar spine in the anterior direction. So that's basically what we're talking about when we're talking about anterior orientation of the pelvis versus what is actually referred to as a pelvic tilt.
Yeah, pelvic tilt being a very specific biomechanically measured angle. What do they traditionally use that for?
Well, there's a number of angles that would be used. Pelvic tilt, pelvic incidence, sacral slope, things like that. They're trying to look at two-dimensional relationships. And so you'll see tilting variation or explanations rather that go all the way up into the spine just for people to look at things and resolve them into a more simplistic representation. So we can have a discussion about position.
I'm holding a spine and pelvis model. Nice. So this would be like a good example of someone that has lost relative motion, because these bones are supposed to move on each other, relatively speaking, but these are all locked up with screws and bolts and stuff. So in the instance where compression has eliminated my ability to have relative motion, so everything is going to move in one piece, and I'm going to get an anterior orientation, which is everything moving together forward, which will increase the lumbar curvature, versus the posterior orientation would be increasing the lumbar curvature in the opposite direction, because everything is moving.
That's a big fat maybe, boss.
Okay, well, explain to me why normally people would say that, and why that
Okay, people see what they want to see. Here's what you want to try to understand is, and this is why a posterior orientation is not the solution to an anterior orientation, because the actual relationship of the pelvis itself relative to the spine doesn't change. And this is a toughie to accept and a tough one to see, because when we're dealing with situations where we don't have relative motion between each segment, it's a really tough thing to accept, but you got to put all the pieces together. So put your anterior orientation up there for me. So there you go. The inlet of the pelvis is oriented more forward than what we would typically expect. We've got a big curvature of the spine, right? So here's what people think is happening in the circumstance where they would intentionally try to posteriorly orient. What I want you to do is I want you to reverse the position of the pelvis and let the spinal joints expand. Okay. That's not happening when you are posteriorly orienting from a position of anterior orientation. It's a muscle activity that is compressing the spine. So the joints of the spine are being compressed downward, okay, to the point where there is no relative motion. So we don't have segmental motion in the pelvis itself. We don't have segmental motion in the lumbar spine. Now, what I want you to do, Chris, and this is going to be hard for you to do because it's a plastic model. What I want you to do is I want you to maintain the position of the spine and the position of the pelvis relative to each other. And then I want you to bend the spine downward from the top. Okay. All right. So this would be an increase in the muscle activity on the front side of the axial skeleton. So for the sake of argument, we'll say rectus abdominis is becoming concentrically oriented. Now, because you have bent the spine, what I want you to do is now keep all the relationship the same and just lean the spine backwards. That is what is happening when people are trying to posteriorly orient the pelvis from a position of anterior orientation. All you're doing is you're compressing the axial skeleton harder in the downward direction, which is magnifying all of the pressures that were associated with the anterior orientation. One of these things that you have to recognize is as people sort of layer on these compensatory strategies, if I add another compensatory strategy on top of it, the other one doesn't really go away. So what ended up happening is this is why you start bending stuff versus actually accessing relative motion, segmental relative motion. So these are connective tissue behaviors that are actually taking place. Right. And then eventually, with enough pressure associated with these things, I can start to get destruction of tissues. And so, for instance, I could start to degenerate a disc. I could start to reduce the resiliency of those discs. And now I do apply enough of an anterior pressure through a disc, and then I get a disc herniation in that circumstance. Right. Or like someone that would be described as having a severe kyphosis, they actually went into an anterior orientation and then basically pushed themselves down. They bent the spine enough that it actually shifted the center of gravity. It shifts the center of gravity, but it doesn't change the orientation or the relationship between the spine and the pelvis enough to actually truly describe it as a posterior orientation. So posterior orientation is an anterior orientation that's tilted back and they pull it down harder on the front. So you actually get shorter. You'll physically get shorter. Right. You'll see a magnification of early external rotation measures in both the hip and the shoulder in that circumstance. And the reason that you would see that is because everything's moving as one piece. And so you get this big curvature that you've created by pulling down. That curvature is exposed in the back.
You're going to lose IR because
you're going to lose IR. So so internal rotation is downforce. And so you just have to figure out a way to push down, because you're in essence you could eventually fall backwards by bending the spine enough, because you're going to move in the direction of the gradient. So you're going to create a anterior to posterior pressure gradient, right? But it's not an expansion that would be up and away from midline. It's just literally an expansion away from midline. So you could actually fall backwards. And so you continue to pull yourself down and forward, but you're not gaining relative motions under any circumstance. You're taking away your ability to access, the ability to turn inward. This will be the people that walk in and they have no butt, right? You can't see, they don't need a glute max because of the way that they're balanced over their base of support. And so then like older folks, especially, like go to the nursing home and you'll see that the older guys, eventually their belt line creeps up and up and up higher up on their abs because they don't have anything to hang their belt on anymore.
Yeah.
But that's the most extreme scenarios.
Okay. Let's take a step back a little bit. We touched on a lot of important concepts. We talked about compressions. We've talked about compensation strategies. We've mm-hmm. talked about squeezing certain muscles and compressing down. Let's take a step back to, how did someone get to this place of anterior pelvic orientation to begin with? What led them to this place?
Because we're always moving forward, right? And so our physical structure demands that we are managing our center of gravity, hopefully within our base of support. But to do so in most circumstances, we have internal dynamics that's caused by gut behavior that we have to manage. We have gravity that we have to manage. So we're always resisting those things. And over time, if we start to use superficial musculature to hold ourselves in position, it alters the way that we breathe. It alters our extremity motions. And then so we have to use substitutions for relative motion. So relative motion would be joints that can move in opposition. But if we squeeze those joints together hard enough, they actually start moving together. And so we would have knees that don't bend as well. We would have elbows that don't bend as well. We would have shoulders that would lose our rotation. So if you're ever in a situation where you reach behind your back to tuck your shirt and you go, well, that's a little bit harder than it used to be, or you're putting your coat on and you can't reach back and you can't get your hand into the sleeve, those are the situations that you would start to recognize. Or you just change strategy. And so instead of reaching behind to put your hand in your coat, you start doing this one, the overhead thingy, and pulling it down. So people figure out ways to work around this. So they might not notice some of these things, but it's always happening because right. we're always going to be moving forward as we apply these strategies. Everybody will experience them to a degree, just because of the bias of your structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a human system with very similar anatomy. You're going to have different structural archetypes that we've talked about at length in this podcast and on the network. The long and the short of it is, when you put this structure and this anatomy into a gravity field and you have to move forward through space in order to accomplish tasks every day of your life, and you have to breathe, that there's a path of least resistance, given the summation of all of these forces, that's going to put you in positions that make certain things have to squeeze and compensate in order to keep you moving forward and breathing.
Right. And so you don't lose your balance.
Yeah. The gravity management component is one we're going to come back to. So we are going to get into how reduction of muscle activity and the movement of the center of gravity and the management of the center of gravity is the solution. But before we talk about that, I wanted to discuss the traditional perspective on what causes anterior pelvic tilt and why that's sort of misguided and why we want to have people reconsider. So typical things that you're going to hear are tight low back, tight hip flexors, psoas needs to be released.
Yep.
What are the other things?
Weak glutes.
Weak glutes is a big one.
Or they have forgotten what to do.
Yeah, okay. They have amnesia.
Yes.
They've forgotten who they are. Blaming tight muscles, blaming the whole stretch and strengthen concept of blaming this muscle for not being strong enough and this muscle that's too tight and needs to be stretched. These are lagging indicators of the problem or the root cause of the problem, right?
Right. Yeah, we're seeing the results. We're seeing the results of the behavior. So if I am reducing my base of support, the likelihood of my falling increases. And we all have the reflex in our head that says, don't fall. And so then we have to strategize as to how to keep the center of gravity inside of the base of support. And the way that we do that is we push down harder. We hold ourselves down. And this is the result, is that we reduce the base of support, reducing access to relative motion. So we lose our ability to turn inward and push down. But yet we have degeneracy built within our system that we find other ways to do it. And so the anti-orientation of the pelvis is a substitution for the relative motion internal rotation. So we orient the pelvis more forward so we can push down harder inside the limited base of support. But in doing so, we have to increase the activity of certain muscles to do so. And so this is where, like, if you want to pick on psoas isn't doing anything by itself. But it is participating, and it's a big fan of pushing down. But that's why, you know, there's like books written about the psoas problem. It's like, it's not a psoas problem. It's a center of gravity issue that's associated with being a human and bipedal with guts. It's like, that's what it is, right? And so that's why we can pick on that. That's why it's easy to pick out, because we're going to see it so much, because we're all going to eventually default into this strategy. But you've got other musculature that's associated with, you know, hip position, pelvic orientation, and the reduction of the relative motion within the pelvis, that we could say that every single one of those is a problem. We could write a book about each one of those if we really wanted to. It's like, oh, the piriformis problem, or the psoas problem, or the iliacus problem. Take your pick. Everybody's going to be right under that circumstance, right? Because it's pretty easy to pick them out.
Yeah.
But it's not like we're going to force somebody into a position. So trying to stretch a hip flexor in this circumstance is an exercise in futility, because you're not providing a solution to the problem. The problem is that I've got a center of gravity that's moving forward. Therefore, I have to turn these muscles on. Yanking and pulling on them does not increase their length, nor does it give you any respite from the strategy that you're using, right? The solution is restore the capability of managing the center of gravity inside of your base of support, which would mean that I no longer need these muscles to be active. Therefore, I would regain my relative motion in that circumstance. So you have muscles that are turned on because of the position. I need to be able to change the position so I can turn those muscles off. And I'm really hesitant to say that because I really hate that perspective. But I think for a lot of people, it would make more sense in that circumstance, because they think of things being either off or on versus gradients.
Yeah, let's change the language then. Let's talk about it from a perspective of reducing muscle activity instead.
How I would look at it. It's like, I don't want my psoas to turn off. I just don't want it to be so busy. I don't want my pelvic musculature to be off. I just don't want it to be as busy. I want it to be active when I want it to be active. So the reason people say that, oh, you've got weak glutes, it's like, well, if I change the orientation of the pelvis, I change the orientation of the muscles, like the position of the muscles changes. I have muscles that could be external rotators in one circumstance and internal rotators in another, and that's exactly what happens. Or I have a position that moves the attachment sites of a muscle further apart. Well, that makes it the perception is that it's weaker, when in reality it's just eccentrically oriented and doesn't produce as much force in that position, right? So yeah. you could try to strengthen a muscle all day by doing an exercise that claims to strengthen a muscle, right? But the reality is, like, if I don't change my ability to manage the center of gravity, as soon as I stand back up, guess what happens? Same thing.
Yeah. So in a lot of cases,
you hope that you accidentally do something right.
That's what I was exactly what I was about to get into. So there are going to be people yelling in the back. The only thing that ever helped me with my anterior pelvic tilt and my hip pain was a couch stretch, or this stretch, or that stretch, or did my groin stretching where I did like a frog position, and that fixed it. So I would like to try to reconsider. Let's make a counterfactual argument. Like, what potentially was happening? If I do a quad stretch in side lying, I'm not just stretching my quad. That's not what actually is happening. I'm taking the shape of putting someone's skeleton on the ground on its side. I'm using the ground. I'm getting front to back dimension back. I'm creating different spaces where there wasn't space before. Yes. The same could be said with a half kneeling drill, or someone doing an adductor rock where you're in half kneeling and you open your front knee is actually creating the space that you've lost and then moving through that space. It has nothing to do with the stretching. It's more about the managing the center of gravity.
It's literally the positions that you're creating are teaching you how to remanage your center of gravity.
Yes.
Now, the problem with that is that is that by trying to treat everybody the same, right, they don't all have the same starting conditions.
Yes.
Right. Which is why you would have sort of like a hit and miss. And that's why there will be a group of people that will go, but I did this and it worked out great. Well, your perception is that you're strengthening the muscle. The perception is that it's because of the stretch. You didn't even recognize the position that you were in when you did it. Right. You didn't even realize that you did something and you stopped holding your breath. And then that allowed you to actually reduce muscle activity that allowed you to shift your center of gravity. And then that's why you got a favorable result. It's like, okay, you know, have whatever perception that you want, but maybe you just don't have a broad enough perspective as to what's happening when you do have a successful outcome. Because if a stretch and strengthened perception worked, it should work every time. But right. Why doesn't it? Right.
What are the differences? That's what we offer when trying to teach your model to people is like when you start to, as you get further into this and you keep asking the right questions and you're working with lots of different people, there becomes these exceptions to these rules that you've developed for yourself or that you've learned. Right. And if the exceptions are always happening and you don't have any sort of answer for them and you have to come up with new rules, then it's time to figure out like the actual root cause of what you're, or figure out how you're perceiving this from the wrong angle. But that's it. So I just want to give one more example. Typical half kneeling stretches and positions, utilizing activities where you strengthen the hips. So if I give someone a goblet squat and they do their stretches and their goblet squat, their hip pain and back pain goes away. And I've visually decreased their anterior pelvic tilt through what they perceive as a stretching and strengthening protocol, right?
Right.
But what we're offering as a reconsideration is perhaps they've changed the shape and the way that they manage center of gravity with these stretching positions, and then they've utilized another strength activity that's moving the center of mass and retaining the center of mass within the base of support with the goblet squat, and that's provided the solution. How do we, as in terms of solutions, how do we reduce muscle activity to start? And then what can we do to move the center of gravity? Let's give concrete examples instead of just in general.
If forward is part of the problem, right, we're always going to be moving in that forward direction. And that's going to reduce the access to space that I can push downward. So imagine a square that's just narrowing front to back as you move forward, stands to reason that I need to recapture that space. And so this is going to be where you're going to use activities where your center of gravity is actually behind the ground contact. So to give you an example, the most extreme representation of this would be hook lying. So I lay on my back, I bend my knees, I put my feet on the ground. I've immediately moved my center of gravity behind the ground contact to the most extreme position possible. Now, doesn't guarantee that this is going to be the resolution. I'm using it as a representation of how you would position yourself. If I was to do like a suspension trainer squat where I can actually lean backwards into a reclined position, my feet are on the ground and I can do a squat in that position, also reclined, also taking advantage of the same premise that I am positioning my center of gravity behind my foot contacts, as I can access greater degrees of relative motion in that circumstance, then I can actually train myself to maintain the shape that I need to actually expand the space in which my center of gravity can behave. And so then that gives me the advantage of being able to reduce the muscle activity that was contributing to my ability to push down as I moved forward and I lost my base of support. Right. So those are examples of that. It could be something as simple as laying down on your right side. Okay. So when you lay on your right side, the behavior internally that's driving this whole show to begin with is actually reduced. So I actually reduced the stimulus that caused my center of gravity to shift forward in the first place. Right. So if you're doing your hip stretch or something and you happen to be laying on your side, it's like, it's not necessarily the hip stretch that was making the effect at all. It was could very well have been the fact that you actually laid on your side and you made it easier for your system to actually reduce the muscle activity that was interfering. Right. So those would be very concrete examples. So the position of your body matters. Your position in space matters. And if I can slow that progression, that forward progression center of gravity, I have actually reduced the muscle activity that would interfere with my ability to move or produce what people would would see as the anti-orientation of the pelvis.
Right. You gave a couple like home run examples. I want to offer a stepwise progression of doing things. So we're talking about reducing muscle activity first. You sort of touched on these things. We've talked about them very recently on the podcast about utilizing foam rolling for hip and shoulder mobility.
Yes, sir.
So reducing muscle activity is not so much about stretching the muscle, because that actually can increase muscle activity in some cases.
There's plenty of research to indicate that it would actually increase. Yeah.
So we can utilize, instead of blindly utilizing foam rolling and massage, we can have a little more of a targeted approach that we've discussed in past episodes. So I don't want to necessarily get into that, but utilizing a foam roller and the ground for rolling activities.
Correct.
On both the foam roller and rolling activities on the ground can be useful to change the shape and create the space that we want. Then breathing in those positions, like you said, would further occupy that space and increase that space. And then we want to use activities and exercises to move the center of gravity, which you gave an example of, like a reclined TRX squat.
Yes.
Like another example would be, let's talk about utilizing, because we talked about it earlier, let's talk about utilizing a ramp in like a goblet squat and how that might
Okay, help. So a ramp elevated goblet squat. So by position, center of gravity goes up. Okay. That's a very good thing, right? So we're adding external rotation. So remember, this is a loss of dimension, which is going to take away our external rotation. So external rotation is going to move away from midline. Center of gravity goes forward. I start pushing down harder. As soon as I elevate my heels, I give myself more space to land that external rotation front to back. So then it becomes very useful. In the goblet position, I'm adding load above my natural center of gravity, which raises my center of gravity. So again, it increases the amount of downforce that I can actually apply into the ground. Thirdly, because I've displaced load anteriorly, my natural response is to move away from that load to distribute the center, my new center of gravity, over my base of support. So here's what I did. I lightened myself up. I took away the need for me to push down, and I expanded my center of gravity posteriorly, so I can now land inside of it more effectively. So that's a big money activity for folks to do. And the way you know is because if you try to squat and you have any issues acquiring depth, and you put yourself on a ramp and you can suddenly squat deeper, that's indicative of the fact that you've actually reduced the interfering muscle activity that was pushing you forward.
Okay. So yeah, we talked about the traditional perspective, what anterior pelvic tilt actually is and the difference between that and orientation, why posterior pelvic tilt or posterior pelvic orientation is not the answer, just because we talked about the compression and the compensation strategies from moving forward through space squeeze you in a way that anteriorly orients your pelvis. Posteriorly orienting the pelvis is just further squeezing yourself and exacerbating your issue. So you may end up picking up certain ranges of motion that a therapist or a chiropractor might find valuable on a table, but you are setting yourself up in a probabilistic sense for potentially more problems down the road.
Yes.
We offered what traditionally people try to do and why there could be some use in the old things that people were trying to do, but not from the reasoning perspective that they might think.
Correct.
And then we offered some strategies for reducing the muscle activity first, creating the shape on the ground, and then utilizing activities to help manage center of gravity through like a goblet squat or a TRX squat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we fixed everyone's anterior pelvic orientation. You're welcome. If you've gotten to the end of this and you haven't joined the UHP network, please do so. We talk about stuff like this all the time. And Bill writes articles every week about stuff like this, where we get a lot of our inspiration for the podcast. So that's UHP.network. There is a free trial there for the member side for three days for anyone that would like to join in there.
When's our anniversary?
Of what? Oh, it's soon. May?
Is it in May?
I think April was when we started the early access.
Okay.
So we're about there.
On our first anniversary. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. So it's been around for about a year. It's been, there's 2,200 people in there now.
Yeah.
So it's grown quite a bit. Okay, question for this week for everyone sticking along.
Still watching. All right.
Dale. I want to know, Dale, and everyone else watching. What was your first concert?
Oh, I know exactly which one.
Of course, everyone knows their first concert.
Oh my gosh! Yes. Do you want to know mine? Do you want to know mine?
Go first.
Okay. Eighth grade. Nice. There's a great story that goes with this too. I wish I could tell it. 38 Special opening up for Cheap Trick. Nice. It was amazing because I loved both of those bands at the time. Yeah, my brother took me to my very first concert. It was at the War Memorial Coliseum in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It was festival seating, which means there was no seating. You just stood on you ran in through the doors as soon as they opened, and you got up to the front of the stage before everybody else. Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome.
Nice.
Yeah, great.
When I was little, I didn't really go. I wasn't really interested in like going to see certain bands, but we went to see like a lot of Philharmonic. So like, Rochester, like Philharmonic Orchestra. I think Toronto or Montreal also I saw. I've been to like the Jazz Fest and stuff in Montreal. So I saw a lot of live music like that. The first concert for like a band, I think I went to see Less Than Jake when I was like a freshman in college.
Less Than Jake.
It's like a punk rock band.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like that's a good punk rock
band. It's like the ska punk style where they have like trumpets and trombones and stuff.
It's lost on me. I'm sorry.
Yeah. If you heard the style of music, it would be reminiscent. I don't know.
If I don't even know the genre.
Right. Bill knows what Bill knows. But yeah, leave in the comments what your first
concert. That's awesome. Good one. That's a good one.